This is Turn One Thoughtsies. I'm Aaron.
And I'm Zach.
And this is episode 63, Modern Pro Tour Aftermath, / No More Silly Episode Names.
You putting the end to it?
I think so. I honestly was looking back in like the history, the naming episode history, and like they're clever to a certain extent, but they're not descriptive enough to be like search engine friendly.
That's fair.
And so I was like, all right, I need to just like lock in after, 72 episodes, I need to lock in a naming scheme and, you know, really, really buckle down. And I have to start being better about doing like the tags and all the stuff inside and all the search engine flimflam.
Sure.
The kids are doing today with their internets.
Yeah, I mean, is the world we live in now, right?
Their MP3s.
Well, we don't live in that world anymore.
Okay, fair. Anyways, so there was a Modern Pro Tour.
There was.
And aside from the villain of the picture winning, it was good. Actually, that's not true. It was great.
Oh man, Pro Tour was excellent.
Oh god, it was really good.
I mean, this was one of the most compelling Pro Tours we've seen. Oh geez. I can't remember a Pro Tour that I had this much fun watching and was this excited. I think the last one was Sean McLaren's, honestly.
I was not excited to see a draw in round one.
No, that was scary. It was a little bit scary.
I was just like, yeah, I was like, man, if these people can't close, like if the best players in the world can't close on camera on the first day when they're still like totally fresh, it's not like, oh, I've been playing for 10 hours. I was just like, oh god, this is gonna be terrible. But they brought it back. Everything after that was great.
Yeah, man, it was a good time. Lots of storylines, very compelling gameplay, healthy format, everything you could want in a Pro Tour.
Tron did very poorly, and I think that people were not expecting that. I certainly was not expecting that, but I also think that people weren't taking the chances that people took were interesting chances, like playing Hollow One.
Sure.
Like that's a bigger chance to me than being like, oh, I'll throw some Blood Suns in my Tron deck.
Sure.
Hollow One ended in top four with like 24 match points. It's pretty crazy.
No, I mean the deck's very powerful. Been under the radar for a while, but it is breaking out now for sure.
Yeah, it's also the reason that Goblin Lore is now a $15 card.
Oh, yeah. That classic Goblin Lore. Modern staple.
Today we're going to cover the Pro Tour as it was. We're going to talk about Lantern, obviously. And we're going to go over some unbans. We're going to go over our predictions, see if our predictions carried any water. And spoiler alert, they pretty much did. So I was pretty pleased, except for like the biggest obvious miss in. It was pretty silly. The thing that we missed was really quite expansive.
Oh yeah, we had a big whiff. But you know, you're gonna have some of those. It's tough to knock down a whole format at once,
I guess. So, the other thing that I want to mention before we get too deep into it is the continuing Wizards support of the Modern format is the Team Modern Super League has started. As of this recording, week one has started. This will come out the day before the next Team Modern Super League, which is Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific time, which for people overseas is GMT minus 8. Is that right?
I have no idea.
I think Well, it's three hours behind us. We're GMT minus five. So, yeah. So, GMT minus eight.
Sure.
It is at twitch.tv/magic. It's Li Shichan, Ralph Levy, Patrick Diekmann versus Emma Handy, Megan Wolf, and Sam Illenfelt. I don't know. I'm not familiar with his body of work.
He top aided the last standard Pro Tour before this modern one.
Got it.
He's a very talented magician from Minnesota.
Oh, Minnesota.
Yep. And I don't know if you watched, by the way, but Megan from the MTA cast was destroying some pros with some Primeval Titans last night. It was pretty great.
Yes. Yeah. Like, anger off the top.
Yep.
And there was a lot going on there.
Oh, yeah.
But quite good. Sweltering Suns, I really like the addition of Sweltering Suns is a huge game for them.
Yep.
So, and playing the Explorers, too. Like, I like the little changes, and only two summoners packed. Like, four is definitely overkill. But that is what people had been playing previously.
Sure.
So I like the decisions that were made. Boo, Obstinate Bailoff out of the side, but that is what it is. My nemesis. I got Summoner's Pact, Obstinate Bailoff in response to a Liliana activation three times in one game. I got real unhappy.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, okay, do it. Also, please stop doing that.
Yeah, right.
I was very surprised when they kept doing it. I was like, how do you have these many? And they were like, it's the thing that I lose to. So I just pack a ton of hate for it. And I was like, it's fair. I can't, I cannot fault you for going deep on the thing that you always lose to.
Yeah, no. Fair.
The actual breakdown was expansive, I guess would be the best way to describe it.
Talking about the Pro Tour now, right?
Sorry, back to the Pro Tour. 23 decks had five or more pilots in day one.
That's completely insane, but that is also just modern, and that's why we love it, right?
Yes, agreed. Some of the people, like, way down had interesting choices. Well, actually, one person did bring Blue-Red Kiln Fiend, which I was very excited about. I was like, you know what? You go to the Pro Tour, you bring that deck, you're going to get somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, here it is. And the player's name is Ryan Cubitt. Bedlam Revero, Kiln Fiend, Swift Spear, Thing in the Ice. I mean, it's literally just it's Daniela's deck. I don't think there's anything. There's Blood Moons in the side, I think is like the main, and Hercule's Recall. But the 60, I think, is basically exactly what she plays. And got at least 18 match points at a Pro Tour. So that's pretty darn good.
Yeah, it's definitely sweet.
Obviously, more Hollow Ones. There was a lot of Pyromancer. There was a Black-White Zombies deck that played Gravecaller, Dreadwanderer, Bloodghast, Tide Hollow Sculler, and four Smuggler's Copter.
I was going to say, Smuggler's Copter is the big draw on that one, right? I think it's got Lingering and Souls, too, right?
Yeah, it's Lingering Souls, a main deck Surgical Extraction.
Okay.
Which we've covered, I've covered at length before. It's just, I think it's always a mistake, but whatever. Humans, Grixis Control. I was trying to see if anybody just really, like, brought the thunder and registered a Cruel Ultimatum, but I don't see one.
I don't see a Cruel Ultimatum, but there was definitely some Ancestral Visions.
Yes, Ancestral Visions, a lot of Search for Azcantos, not in quantity necessarily, but consistently.
Yep.
John Finkel brought Mono Green Tron.
Yep.
Which was the only Tron version that actually did reasonably well.
No, Black Green Tron did well too.
That's true.
But that's a very similar. It's almost the same deck, honestly. It's like a couple of sideboard cards different.
It's just, no, this one's Mono Green. The one there's two that had 24 match points, and I think they were both. Yeah, they were both mono green.
Okay, so maybe mono green's better, but Yuya Watanabe, I think, got 10th place with Black Green Tron. He might have had less points, so he probably just did better in draft.
Yeah. I didn't see, because the only two I see at 24 match points or higher, or 22 or higher, is two Greentron, Aider Demonesco, Demonseno, and Hannes Karam. And they're both just like balls to the wall, mono green. No fooling.
Sure.
And yeah, and did okay. I feel like the thing that probably held them back. Nope, we're going to talk about that later too. Man, I'm like off. I'm off the rail today.
Yeah, it's wild. It's been a wild cast so far.
Ugh, man, I'm getting, this is going to be a nightmare to edit. But 23 different decks, 5 or more pilots. Most played cards, top 10 non-land cards were Lightning Bolt, Thoughtseize, Path to Exile, Serum Visions, Fatal Push, Snapcaster Mage, Inquisition, Collective Brutality, Noble Hierarch, and Relic of Progenitus.
Anything standing out to you there?
A lot of 1-drops.
Well, I mean, a lot of 1-drops. Yes, there's a lot of 1-drops, but that's something we've seen pretty consistently through modern history, right?
Yeah, I was surprised to see Lightning Bolt that high.
Okay. So Lightning Bolt, I was back, also, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's back as creature removal, as like realistic creature removal. When everybody was playing like Gurmag Anglers and Death Shadows, packing Lightning Bolt as your creature removal was silly.
Sure.
But now with humans and, you know, other like smaller aggro decks, having Lightning Bolt, like four Lightning Bolts against humans is pretty good.
Yeah.
Thoughtseize is always good. Path, same thing. Like I was a little surprised to see Path that high up, but if people were expecting Tron, then you need to be able to have a clean answer to Wormcoil Engine.
Well, it's not even just Wormcoil. I mean, Path is just, it's just a good one mana removal spell, right? Like it hits anything. I mean, that's why people play it.
Yeah, I mean, like Path, Primetime. Yeah,
I think there was. Well, that's one of the few ones where you're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be doing this one, but.
Well, sure. It doesn't feel good. Like nobody's happy to do it, but if the alternative is like getting smashed for, you know, 18. 6 from the Primeval Titan, and yeah, getting whatever 6th or 12th from Valakut triggers, probably just bite the bullet and take the 6 from the ETB and the mountain that they're going to get off the fetch.
No, I mean that's fair. I don't know. The thing that stood out to me is that everything in here costs 1 except Snapcaster Mage, which definitely deserves to be in the top 10 most played cards. I don't think anybody would argue it. That card is fantastic and well known for being fantastic, but Collective Brutality poking its head into this top 10 most played cards kind of stood out to me.
Collective Brutality is it's one of the strongest cards, I think, in terms of format role players that's been printed in a really long time, because you can't, there's no matchup where it's completely dead. It covers a lot, like it's a very good charm, and it has additional upside for like a ton of decks. I'm all aboard the Collective Brutality train. I ran it and continue to run it in 8-rack over Wrenchmind, especially now. Like, ugh, there's so many artifacts. Like, Wrenchmind is just a garbage pile. But Collective Brutality as a 2-for-1, 3-for-1, you know, combination ritual plus discard plus drain plus kill your little guy. Great.
Actually, you know, in the actual top 8, you know, Collective Brutality was the most played removal spell among all the top 8 decks? I mean, that's kind of outrageous to me, but it actually was.
Yeah, I mean the pros have I correctly identified that like Fatal Push, while very good, needs support. Like it's a good secondary removal spell.
Well, yeah.
So
I mean, I think the decks that play Fatal Push, it is the primary removal spell, but it has glaring flaws, right? Yes. So like in those spots, like it doesn't get the job done by itself.
Right.
Which Collective Brutality does a good job helping with. Path does a good job helping with.
Yeah. I mean, Dismember is really the...
Dismember also, very good. Dismember, I think, of those spells, covers Collective Brutality, or Fatal Push's weaknesses the best with how people are attacking Fatal Push currently.
Yeah.
You see a lot of 5-mana 5/5s right now.
Yep.
Or 6-mana.
Yeah, I really like... some of the Traverse Shadow lists that came in like 27 the 27 match point Traverse Shadow list played a 3-1 split Fatal Push Dismember with 2 Abrupt Decays. I love that. Like that feels really good to me.
Sure.
I mean Reduke, 4 push, 2 decay, 2 Maelstrom Pulse. I could see skimping on a Dismember there because you have Maelstrom Pulse.
Yeah, but it actually ended up costing him. If you watched him lose in the top 8, he would have given a lot to have a Dismember to hit that turn 1 hollow one.
Yep. That is true.
Certainly worth 4 life at that point.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yep. Yeah, take one hit in advance, not take 12 points of damage over the course of the game.
Yeah. Well, not just lose. Like, it does even more than that, right? Like, you have a hollow one, it turns on Flamewake Phoenixes, like...
Yeah. No, that's true.
I mean...
Yeah, there's a lot going on. And that's... Yeah. I really like that deck. But I was super pleased to see, like, a completely... It's just a green-black. Like, I've got an hour and 45 minutes of material on like Reduke's green black like splash white for Lingering Souls deck.
Sure.
But I will spare everyone because it's green black with white for Lingering Souls. Sometimes you don't even need to cast the front half of Lingering Souls because you're just going to be discarding it. And then sideboard cards.
Yep. But the sideboard cards matter. They're good.
Yeah, 3 Stony Silence, 3 Collective Brutality. Very good. God, there's just so much information. I'm trying to like wrap my head around it, and I've been thinking about it for like a week, and I'm still just like, where do we even like start to cut up this pie?
Well, I've got one for you. Let's go over what we thought was going to happen with our predictions from the last episode and see how they actually compared.
Yes. So we said Storm, Death Shadow, Lantern Affinity, Blue X, Search for Azcanta, and Tron would make up the majority of the field. And we hit that pretty good. That was a very comprehensive slice of like day one, day two. Well, more day one. Some of those decks did not convert well into day two. Like, primarily Tron had very poor conversion. But everybody else seemed to do pretty okay on our list.
Yeah, those were the majority of the most played decks. The interesting thing is we anticipated Lantern to be a lot bigger than it actually was. Except that Lantern actually didn't show up in good numbers, but it did very well. The people who played it didn't even do that well, but it won. It won the event, so
it had very high like match win percentages.
Yep.
But I think the other people that played it didn't do as well in draft.
Sure.
So that didn't carry them.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because I think only like 9 people showed up with it, but like 65% of them day two'd or something like that. Like it had a big, yeah. So there were 9 Lantern pilots, 6 of them day two'd. So it has 66.7% conversion rate, By contrast, like Storm had a 56.5% conversion rate. Jeskai Control, 73.9. Oh, that's very good. Grixis Shadow, 66. So it had the same conversion rate as Grixis Shadow, despite having a third fewer pilots.
Sure.
Like, it had almost the same conversion rate as, like, Tron and Five Color Humans and, like, Affinity. I mean, these were all nutty. Hollow One had an 83% conversion rate from day one to day two.
Yeah, Hollow One six was players, great.
Six players brought it. Five of them day two'd.
I mean, the best one was Five Color Death Shadow, right? They had, like, an 87% conversion rate or something. Or, like, 93%. There was like 13 players playing Five Color Death Shadow, and I think 11 of them day two'd. I think that was the actual number.
Yeah, I mean it's not the whole picture, because like Blue Black Fairies, Breach, and Blue Red Pyromancer all had 100% conversion rates into day two.
Yeah, but those were like one or two pilots, right? Like that's
yes,
that's a different story than 13 players playing a deck and 11 of them day two'ing. That's crazy.
Yes. Yeah. Traverse Shadow, 84.6%. So I guess that's four color.
Yep.
So the thing that we missed that we alluded to in the beginning was we didn't put humans on the list for some reason.
Yeah, that was probably a punt.
And I'm trying to remember, like, recording. I'm like, how did we miss? Or how did we not put humans on there, I guess?
Well, it seems like it's a big thing now, but like, at the time, like before the event, humans had been doing okay in SCGs, but it was never a huge part of the field. Humans, you know, it's a very good deck. I mean, it's starting to get the respect that it deserves to get, but before the PT, it wasn't recognized as being as big as it actually was. And now looking back, it's like, it's obvious. It's like, yeah, we missed humans, but I don't think it was totally unjustified to leave it off of the anticipated field. I mean, obviously, looking back, it was the most played deck, so that's pretty bad, but, you know.
Sure.
That's hindsight,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, I looked back at the show notes for last episode, and it looks like we picked Affinity as, like, the aggro deck that we thought most people would pick because it's been around the longest, and it's the sort of the bar, the gold standard for aggro decks, pretty much, for the almost the life of Modern. So we assumed that more experienced players would choose Affinity as their aggro deck of choice, and it just turns out that more of them picked humans.
Well, I think the humans deck is just better than everybody thought, because, like, individually, a whole bunch of pro testing teams came to the conclusion that if I'm playing aggro, I should be playing humans. And, you know, I think that's something we're going to see moving forward, is that other aggro decks are going to start fading. Humans isn't going to push everything out. It's not like all these other aggro decks are suddenly unplayable, but it's like, you know, humans about to start stealing metagame share from other aggro decks. Like, if Affinity was 10% of the field, now it'll be like 9 or 8 or whatever, and you know, some percentage of those Affinity players are going to be playing humans now, and they're probably right to do it because that deck is disruptive and incredibly fast.
Yes, and also anybody that is sleeving up humans, it is, I can guarantee it is 100% incorrect to play less than 2 Kessig Malcontents in the main, and it's probably defensible to play 3.
I would believe that.
That's my take. I can't see playing like ETB Domu for 6 ever being a one of. There's just that number has to go up. That's my free advice for humans is play more Kessig Malcontents, because that card is nuts.
I mean, to be fair, when I'm playing against humans, it's always this card I'm most scared of, and you heard it actually on coverage. There's like a time where Jerry T is playing against, I think, Javier Dominguez. And he goes, don't draw the Kessig Malcontents.
Yeah.
He's like, it's only a one of. I can only draw one.
Yeah.
It's like, well, maybe if you played 2 or 3.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Right, rip the second one off the top.
Yep.
Dome, you win.
All right, so how'd our speculation go?
So, breakout deck, I picked Red Green Tron, you picked Lantern. I mean, you know.
Yeah, some, you know, broken clocks, right, twice a day, I guess you can say.
Once again, both of us missing humans.
Well, to be fair, my breakout deck did win, so...
Yes, you win, right? You get the points for that one.
Fair.
So I said Red Green Tron. I still stand by it. I think that if someone had taken the risk to put together a sweeper heavy Tron deck that was, you know, red green, given how the field actually shook out, it would have paid off. Right, they would have not lost to humans, and their game two against decks like Lantern is so much better because they can just straight up play Destructive Revelry, Ancient Grudge. Like they don't have to be afraid of the hate because Red Green has answers for all that stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean that's fair. I think one of the things Tron decks missed is that a Tron deck playing Kozilek's Return would have been very, very well positioned in this format.
Yes. And the thing that I think went wrong is Oblivion Stone and Ugin are normally like the sweepers, but Oblivion Stone is too slow. It just is. And Ugin does not interact with anything in Lantern, really, like dome you for three, hope to ultimate and hit something, but if they've got you completely locked out, you may not be able to race them, and they can just like whir Pithing Needle, naming Ugin, have a nice day.
Sure.
You know, whereas normally you can just like turn four, you can slam Ugin and just exile most decks' entire board.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also like Karn, you know, picking off one thing, you know, like one permanent, exiling one permanent at a time every other turn is not going to get you there. And it suffers from the same, like I said, same thing. When they can just tinker for Pithing Needle in response to the Planeswalker activation, you know, you'll get your one thing. And then it won't make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, Tron actually is good against Lantern, but this didn't bear out in this field. It's not great.
So I said most copies in top eight. I said Jeskai. You said Shadow. The correct answer was humans. If you stretch it out to like 22 or more match points. Actually, I think it was still humans.
It was definitely still humans.
No, it was Grixis Shadow.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 1, 2, 3. I don't know. 1, 2, 3. Yeah, so it was like tied Grixis Shadow and humans. So you kind of get a Corey Burkhart, Grixis Control, 24 points, baby.
Yeah, Corey killed it.
Yep, Counter Squall. That is a sensual play.
That's a good one to beat a Lantern control opponent with. Oh, yeah. Nice Witchbane Orb. You lose 2 life still.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Heavy on Surgical Postboard. I actually like that too.
Yeah, Surgical's always been very good in that deck. Pairs very well with what he's trying to do.
Yeah, Terminate, Logic Knot. 4 Colligan's Command. That feels strong.
That's the Corey Burkhart special. That's his brand. That's what he does. He plays 4 K Commands and 4 Cryptics and 52 other cards. Probably 4 Snaps too. So like 48 other cards.
It's a good brand, right? Yeah. Like that's very, very strong. And worst deck to top 32. You said Through the Breach. I said Merfolk. We were both wrong. there was a Bogles deck that finished with 24 match points, and I guarantee you that the only reason that they were able to do that is that they were main decking for Leyline of Sanctity.
That's aggressive, but I like it.
I mean, it's if right, it's go hard on the only thing that you lose to, which is getting Inquisitioned and having your single, you know, Glade Cover Scout, and then having nothing to play.
Sure. I mean, Leyline's actually good in that deck, though, because they have enchantments that, like, give you extra buffs from the more enchantments you have in play, so it's...
Yep, it's like, Ethereal Armor's great. Yeah,
it's like a proactive plus one, too, for your creature.
Yeah. you know, but they have... They've also got, like, all the good sideboard cards.
Yeah.
Right? They've got, like, Gaddock Teague, I think, must have been insane against a lot of this field. Yep. Like, Rest in Peace. Like, the sideboard was tight. Three Gaddock Teague, three Rest in Peace, three Stony Silence, Spirit Link, three Seal of Primordium, and two Paths, with two Paths in the main. Yeah, I mean, they had answers to all the things.
Yeah, I mean, so. I mean, it's still a terrible deck. It's probably got to be... It's got to come in right behind Hollow One as the deck most likely to lose to itself, but at the same time, when it has its good draws, it feels very unfair.
Yeah, and I guess, like, it's a deck that you probably have to mulligan more often, so, like, there's less opportunity cost loss to playing the four ley lines, because, like, you can't keep an opening hand without a creature.
Sure.
And you only play 12 creatures, so... You're probably going to be shipping a number of hands. So throw four ley lines in there. What the hell?
I mean, it's also good because it protects against Liliana of the Veil, which was a player at the event.
Yes.
You can't get edicted when you have a ley line in play.
Yeah. Well, that's also, right, that's the other thing, right? Go deep on the thing that you lose to. Sure. Liliana Minus is, like, they have... They play fetch lands with Dryad Arbor specifically to combat one card in the entire format.
Yeah. It's no joke.
So, that is that. Card most likely to get banned. I said Mox Opal. You said Brawl / Grapeshot. I think it's really Ancient Stirrings. Like, that's what we actually learned.
Well, so I'm not sure I agree with that. That Ancient Stirrings is more likely to get banned than Mox Opal. I think they're, like, pretty even right now. I don't think that necessarily either of them will get banned. I do think they're more likely that one of those gets banned than Grapeshot or Brawl. So I think you got me here, but I think it's, like, kind of even that it would be between Mox Opal and Ancient Stirrings, just because they're both pretty offensive cards if you just look at them on power level, you know?
Right. When we go over Lantern, like, I'll come back to it, but... So, most played color, I said black, you said blue. You nailed this one. But yeah, no, I...
Okay. Go look at the top 10 cards. Four of them were black.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, it's just very clear. The reason I thought I kind of won was that there's a lot of blue creatures in humans. But that hardly counts, so.
So, Rivals card... I didn't see any. So, Ixalan Rivals card... So, it was Ixalan / Rivals card most likely to show up, other than Bloodsun, which was another, like...
Well, yeah, the category says Ixalan Rivals card, but we both picked Rivals cards, and I think that's what we kind of intended.
Yeah,
but
I didn't see any. Like, there were some Hostage Takers.
That's Ixalan, though. No, there was a human that showed up. Dire Fleet Daredevil from the new set. It was the most appearing new modern card.
Oh, Red Snapcaster. Yep.
The one that Snapcaster's their library or graveyard.
Yeah. Instant or sorcery.
Which, it's not clear if that card's very good, but it definitely is, I don't know, it showed up more than any other card in the set, so.
I mean, it's a card.
It is a card.
I can't imagine in a deck that plays, like, 38 creatures what they're going to be flashing back, but sure.
Well, I think the idea is that the sweet thing is that it tutors their graveyard, so it's like, I think it was mostly a sideboard card, but if you're playing humans and you play against Jeskai Control, like, you're happy to, you know, vial this guy in and hit a Serum Visions or whatever, so.
Oh, it's anybody's graveyard.
No, it's just their graveyard. It's not even yours.
Oh, just their graveyard. Oh.
Yeah.
All right, I mean, yeah. I guess. I don't know. I would be interested to hear tales of its success.
See,
And then also like tales of its just being a 2/1 for two.
I mean, I can see that a lot. That is what it is. But it is. I also don't think it's great at sorcery speed because it's only sorcery speed. It's just a creature that doesn't have flash.
Right.
But with Aether Vial, the card is actually very interesting. I could see it definitely being a sideboard card against Snapcaster Mage decks. It's sweet that it just steals Snapcaster's target and then gets to use it against him.
Yeah, or even just steal it. Like, who cares?
Sure.
All right. I mean, I guess yeah. Sideboard. I will grudgingly agree that it is sideboard playable. But I mean, that's Flicker Wisp too, right? Like Flicker Wisp on its face is an embarrassing card that no one would ever play. With Aether Vial, it's insane.
That's true. I can attest to this. This is very true.
Yeah. So, yeah, we were totally wrong there. Humans was definitely the most played deck. Reduke, Jerry T, top 8. Like, Jerry playing a deck that is very close to my heart and doing very well with it was... I actually said this on Twitter. Like, dream come true. I was so happy. Like, one, to see just mid-range slugfest, like Reduke bringing black green, you know, I feel like it validated my choices and that made me very happy. I was like, I love both of these decks. I have played them at large events. Like I brought Mardu Mentor to my first GP and I brought green black to my second one. And I did poorly at the first one and good at the second one. And that was, you know, to have people that I respect and admire make the same choices that I would make was very, like, gratifying.
Sure. No, I mean, I think they are kind of what made the whole event so watchable, is that they're just very likable people anyway, just personality-wise. You know, they're very respected players in the game, and them doing well... And doing well with sweet decks that you actually want to play is awesome. It was just so fun to watch. And the fact that they're doing well with decks that aren't broken either, that they're kind of, you know, fighting the good fight, if you will, just made it so... Ah, God, it was so great. So much fun to watch. So satisfying to see them do well. And it really... I don't know. It just made coverage so satisfying to me. Seeing Reed beat Tron 3 times was just the absolute greatest, which, like...
Yes.
From having played black-green against Tron numerous times, it feels so unwinnable every time. And he 3-0s it in the event. It's so good.
Yeah, I'm... There's definitely the home team... It had the home team feel.
Oh, yeah.
So... Young Pyromancer did really well... And that is not something that we've seen in a long time.
Not even a long time, ever. Like, there's been this...
No, I mean, in Twin, like, that was a real thing.
It was a real thing, but it was never... That's never what it was about, right? It was like, Young Pyromancer was a card that they played, but it was never about Young Pyromancer. It was always about, you know, Deceiver, Exarch, Twin, Blood Moon. Like, that's what... And Snapcaster Mage, too. That's what those decks were about, but, like, these decks were actually about Young Pyromancer. Like, they were trying to abuse the card, and it did really well. And, like, even more, like, there's been this talk in, you know, just, like, modern circles for a while of this, I don't know, I guess Holy 5 2-drops if you will.
Oh, sure.
Like, you know, the best two drop of every color. Mm-hmm. And there's just, for a long time, kind of been this consensus of best two drop in each color. You know, blue, Snapcaster Mage, black, Dark Confidant, green, Tarmogoyf, white was Forever Stoneforge Mystic. I think we have a new best white two drop, though, because Stoneforge Mystic's not legal in Modern.
Leon and Arbiter.
No. Well, that one is very good.
Relic Seeker.
Also, no.
That one made you a little sad, though.
Yeah, I kind of wanted that one to be good when it was printed, but that was that was not it. I think it's Thalia, and then you can fill in the blank after that, because it's either the Lieutenant or Thalia herself.
Yeah, it's probably Thalia. I mean, just on board impact alone.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Because she's always good.
She's always good. Thalia's Lieutenant's also generally very good. But those two together are kind of there. But Red never really had one. Red forever was just like, what is it? And people speculated for a while that Young Pyromancer was this card, but it never really was, right? Like, it kind of got thrown in this role just to complete the cycle, but it never really put up the results to back its kind of placing, I guess. And... You know, maybe it's there now. Maybe Modern's in a spot now where Young Pyromancer is just this awesome card.
Yeah, until I roll in with my red-green Tron with K returns all over the place, and then what? Then what are you going to do?
Is it Staticaster?
Probably.
Ugh. Yep.
Yeah, those were running around. I saw a bunch of them in a number of sideboards. Along with some spicy, like a little Stormbreath Dragon in the side, some Jeskai lists.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I like that.
There you go. So, I have no idea how to pronounce this person's name. Not even going to try. 21 to 23 match points. Just like Spellqueller, Snapcaster, Geist... Like, just straight Jeskai control, sideboard.
Toru Inoue, for the record.
Okay. Disdainful Stroke, Rest in Peace, Stony Silence, Celestial Purge, 2 Negate, 2 Vendilion Click, Supreme Verdict, Settle the Wreckage.
I like your settle. I think played... Big fan of that.
Two, yeah, no, I do too. And then, like, Stormbreath Dragon, Anger the Gods, like, strong.
This guy can go home with his 3 Cryptic Commands, though. Send that packing.
Sorry, should be 4?
Always.
Okay.
Cut a Geist. He's playing 4 Geist. Jeez, man.
No, I think it was... It looks like he went 2 Logic Knot over 4-1 Cryptic Command Logic Knot.
Well, no, the list I played was like 3 Logic Knot and 4 Cryptic. Or like 2 Logic Knot, 4 Cryptic. He's playing 4 Geist. Most of them only played 3 Geist.
Got it. All right. I believe you. That's not my area of expertise, as you well know.
Fair.
Lot of Shadows Over Innistrad cards, specifically Eldritch Moon cards, and this was a discussion that I had in my group chat and also with a couple of friends. Eldritch Moon is probably definitely the most impactful Modern set in a long time.
Oh, a long, long time, and this set is great.
Like, it has so many hits, and the boxes are still so cheap. I just looked it up on eBay's LARF, and, like, you can still find boxes for, like, $85, and the card list.
Yeah. No, Shadows Over Innistrad was in this weird spot in Standard where... The set and block, well, the block before it was, I think, in or not, it was Expeditions, right? And then the block right after it was Inventions. It was Kaladesh. and Expeditions were wildly successful, and Battle for Zendikar sold like crazy, even though it was a terrible set. Battle for Zendikar was horrible. The second set was actually pretty good because it had the Eldrazi, but that was really all it had. So it wasn't really a good... I mean, it was a good Modern set in the sense that it had Eldrazi, but outside of those, there wasn't cards for decks. It just kind of created its own new deck. And then Shadows came out, and Shadows wasn't really a very impactful set. outside of the fact that it made Dredge a deck by giving it Prized Amalgam and Insolent Neonate.
Right.
So it kind of did the Oath of the Gatewatch thing where it just printed a new deck by giving it Eldrazi or whatever, and doing it for Dredge. And people thought, you know, so people didn't really buy it. It wasn't that successful. It didn't have that many, like, high-selling mythics or pricey lands for Standard, so it didn't look that popular. But looking back now, Shadows, and specifically Eldritch Moon, is looking like one of the best Modern blocks in the last 5 years, honestly.
Yeah. Like, Bedlam Reveler, Collective Brutality, to a lesser degree, Cryptbreaker. Like, that's not zero.
No, that is a Modern power level card.
Like, 13 mana Emrakul sees some fringe play. Eternal Scourge sees some play. Grim Flare.
Eternal Scourge has won a Modern Grand Prix. Like, that's not zero. It actually won a Modern Grand Prix.
Yep. Ishkana, Liliana the Last Hope, Mausoleum Wanderer.
Spellqueller's in Eldritch Moon, too, right?
Selfless Spirit, Spellqueller, Big Thalia. Like,
this set's phenomenal.
There's so much. And still, like, others that are kind
of... Did you say Collective Brutality?
Yeah.
Collective Brutality. I want to give an honorable mention here to Blessed Alliance. I think that's a very, very underplayed Modern card right now.
Sure. Yep. You know, and still, like, a number of things in the, like, rare and mythic slot that have not... I mean, Eldritch Evolution, like, that's something. Distended Mindbender sees fringe play. But there's so much going on in this set. And also just, like, good value cards, like Gyreweech Sanitarium, I've talked about before. I love that card. Harmless Offering is just waiting to be broken. There's tons of stuff.
Yeah, this set is fantastic. Honestly, if you wanted to sit on standard boxes, you know, get a couple, to hold for future value, Eldritch Moon is the way to go. It obviously doesn't have the inventions, but each box is, like, guaranteed to have more value just because Spellqueller, Collective Brutality, like, these are Modern staples at this point, and they're going to continue to be because they're very powerful.
Yeah. I mean, Foil Collective Brutality is $40 right now. Just FYI.
It's $40 right now?
Yes. Oh,
that is crazy. I got really lucky. I wanted to play it opening weekend of that standard format. I got two foil ones for $4 a piece.
Nice.
So that's quite lucky.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so much good here. And even, like I said, other stuff too, like for fringe decks, like Bloodhall Priest is great. Dark Salvation is great. Elder Deep Fiend is just like a card looking for a home.
Yep.
Even like Hanwyr Garrison, Hanwyr Battlements, like those cards, Lupine Prototype never quite got there, but God, I love them anyways.
I mean, you can cast Elder Deep Fiend off of Eldrazi Temple. That is a card that could see Modern play.
Yes.
Having creature type Eldrazi is very relevant in this format.
Yeah, Stromkir Condemned, it's a vampire with two black pips, like, that pumps all of your other vampires with a instant speed discard trigger, like, there's decks out there that want that.
Sure.
Even Tree of Perdition, for all you Commander folks, you can pay $4 for a Tree of Perdition.
Yeah, that one a little less excited about, but it's in the set.
I mean, Triskaidekaphobia is a card that exists.
Yeah. It's a powerful magic card.
I think, doesn't the format of the Gisela, isn't she in some of the, like, core decks? Like, evolution decks?
I don't think so.
4-3 Flying, First Strike, Lifelink. Maybe it's the other one.
I don't think so.
Bruna.
I think it's Lin, but no, it's Linvala, the 3-4 that makes their creatures not activate.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Although, I was trying to convince somebody to let me play Gisela in Legacy, but that is a different story. Or not Gisela, the 4-3 First Strike Lifelink one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Gisela.
That's Gisela, okay.
I mean, the card's good.
I like, mostly just wanted it because it has legendary creature type and you can bounce it with Krakus, but that's a different story.
That's a very different story. That's not a story that I think a lot of people are telling.
Very true.
This story, however, the Lantern Control wins a Pro Tour, it's real. It happened. I watched it happen.
I think everybody watched it happen, right?
It was the most viewed,
I think. The most viewed, and it was also the dullest moment of the entire event.
Yes.
It was awesome all the way up. Like, it was cool that this deck was making this run, and then you got to watch it in the finals, and it was just a bore fest.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people have been sort of being hay over the fact that, like, the blue-white decks were the ones that went to time and blah, 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 blah. And, like, factually, they're not wrong. Contextually, the difference between this field and the average field of like a GP or something is that pro level players know when they are completely locked out and they will just scoop and go to the next game.
Yep.
People that don't know that are going to be taking rounds to time in regular events. Like, that's the issue. It's not that, like, somehow everybody was completely wrong about this deck that takes forever. The deck still takes forever if your opponent doesn't go, okay, I'm 0% to win, let's just go on. And that's exactly what happened in the finals. Is Jerry knew that he was like 0% to win unless he had, like, it was some like ridiculous sequence of cards, and then Luis drew Pyxis, and like Pyxis shuts off his only out, which was like running Faithless Lootings, and then, but having Pyxis in play, he can exile the Faithless Looting, so zero. He's like on a zero outer, and, you know, shook his hand, but there is no. And this happened earlier, too, where, like, Jerry could very easily, if he was not as classy a player and person, really showcased how miserable those matches can be if he was like, go ahead, like, mill me out. You have to actually win the game before the round ends. He didn't.
Well, it also, because it helps that it was untimed, so he has no... There's no benefit to him in doing that, right?
Well, no, but even in the earlier rounds.
Yeah.
You know, that happened in a couple of the earlier rounds, and I don't remember if it was him specifically, but, you know, some of the on-camera matches where, you know, people really could have just dragged it out and been like, all right, cool. You know, make it happen. Show me the win that's not a loop. And show me a loop that I'm 0% to interact with, and if they can't do it, then, you know, activate those Codex Shredders. I hope you can do it fast.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think people are going to learn as the format continues to grow here, and as this deck becomes more popular, when scooping is acceptable and when it's called for. And I think you're right in that, like, going forward for the next, like, couple months-ish, people are going to have a hard time accepting when they're beat, but honestly, it's like, if they have a bridge in play, if you don't have any relevant cards in hand, and they have two lock pieces and a lantern, I mean, you're dead. There is... The chances that you can draw something are so slim at that point that they might as well be zero, and unless you're already in game three, like, if this is game one and they have one lantern, a bridge, and two mill rocks in play, you should probably scoop.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and it doesn't feel good. You're not going to be happy about doing it, but that's the reality. Like, as long as this deck is legal and there are semi-competent people playing it that also understand how to assemble the lock, even though it's kind of autopilot at this point, between, like, Ancient Stirrings and Whir and Mox Opal, like, you really just have to kind of remember that you need to have three specific cards because you have so many ways of getting them. You know, I would be very surprised if it stays as bad as it will be immediately after. Like, Toronto, I think is going to be like Lantern Town. And
see, I don't agree with that, because Lantern is still so hard to play that, like, I think this is going to be a deck that's going to pick up more as time goes on, because now people realize that it's tier one, but it's still a deck you have to learn because it's so different from any other modern deck that it's going to gradually increase in players. Like, I tried to pick this deck up to play it, I don't know, 2 months ago, something like that, and it took me a week before I even felt comfortable playing it. And I pick up decks pretty quickly. I mean, I'm a very competent Magic player, and it's just like, this deck's very confusing. It's very hard.
You draw an opening seven, you're like, what is this nonsense? You're like,
does my hand do anything? Do I have any chance here? Like, every game I played on Magic Online, somebody was going to time either me or my opponent. And it is going to be slower than people are expecting. Like, I think there's a lot of knee-jerk, like, this deck's going to be everywhere, and I think what's going to happen is people are going to buy the deck, they're going to play it one time and be like, what is this? What am I playing with? It's nonsense. And then they'll tinker with it for a little bit and kind of figure it out, but right away I wouldn't expect the growth to be as big as the storylines are. But while we're on the topic of time, before we actually break down the deck, I did want to make the point to people that Lantern is perceived as a very slow deck. So it's like, when you look at Lantern, people are like, oh, slow, grindy games where they control the draw steps, right? But I think people look at the deck completely wrong, and I would advocate to not look at it that way at all. And in fact, I would suggest, when you're playing against Lantern, it is very, very important for you to know when you're dead and to scoop immediately. Because the deck has this, like, incredibly long, drawn-out kill that is going to give you draws that you don't need, when in reality what matters is taking time to make the right decision in the first four turns of the game. Because honestly, that's what's important, is to not let yourself get locked out. Once you're locked out, you're done. Like, the game's over, you need to accept it and move on. But during those first four turns of the game, while they're still trying to get everything set up, making the right play can make the complete difference in the game, where it's like, you know, you get them to mess up and you get to draw a card, or, you know, maybe you get a Thalia down early so they can't empty their hand, that allows you to kill them before they can play a bridge or whatever. But whatever it is, you want to use the 50 minutes you have on your clock in the first four turns and scoop the second you're beat, essentially.
Right. Yeah, there hasn't been, like, people that are newer to Magic than, I'm trying to think of the last time there was, like, a real, actual, like, stone-cold lockout prison deck that was prevalent.
The red-white Mahiri deck, kind of.
But it's the lock is so much weaker.
It was weaker,
right? Like, it's not. Well, it is not a.
The weird thing is that there's never been anything like this, because all the other prison decks were like, you're locked out, and then, like, Leyline of the Void, Helm of Obedience, you're dead. You know?
Yeah, there's that. I mean, I'm in Winter Orb territory. Like, that's where my head is at. Like, people don't have the same level of knowledge, or just this, not the same level of knowledge, same level of experience with decks that, like, Stasis, Winter Orb, like, ridiculous cards that don't get printed and haven't been printed for 15 plus years. Like, that's the kind of mentality where you look at the board and you go, I literally cannot win because I can't play any cards.
Sure.
That is not a feeling that I think a lot of, like, quote-unquote modern, like, people that have come into the game in the sort of, like, new era of design philosophy where prison is not a thing. Like, prison is no longer a supported archetype in official Wizards world. So they do not have that sense of when you just can't win, and it's hard to accept because it is not a feeling that they have had to deal with before, but it is a very real feeling. And, you know, you are not the first person to get locked out by a prison deck. Like, that is the point of a prison deck. Regardless of my personal opinion on, like, prison as an archetype in terms of the game writ large, that's what the decks are designed to do. The cards are legal. So, you know, make a stink, get them banned, or just sideboard appropriately for the time being.
Yeah. No, I mean, the big thing is recognizing when you're beat. I actually thought of an example of the last prison deck I would consider like a very wincon light prison deck. I think like vintage around like 10th edition, like right when Crucible was a thing. Like you, the wincon was literally Mishra's fact. Like it was a Mishra's Workshop deck where it was just spheres, Chalice of the Voids, all sorts of lock pieces that are nonsense, smokestacks. But the only way they could win the game was Mishra's Factory, and they just played Crucible Worlds and Strip Mine and Wasteland to lock you out of mana, and then they'd kill you with a Mishra's Factory that you couldn't kill because they could keep bringing it back. You know, so
right.
But that's kind of the same thing. Yeah. Is like they would like. The game would go years if you let it, but, like, once they had, you know, three lock pieces in play, like, you're not casting spells the rest of the game. It's over. Like, it doesn't matter what they kill you with. And that's the same thing with Lantern. Is like, you just need to recognize when the lock is complete, and then, like, then most of the feel bads go away with the deck, honestly. It's like, yeah, it's frustrating they locked me out, but, like, it's not really different than, like, the Storm player grape-shotting you on that same turn or whatever. Like, if they locked you out on turn four, like, maybe you got grape-shotted out on turn four. It's kind of the same thing, right?
It is. There's a qualitative feeling difference. People will get over it or they won't.
Sure.
I mean, that's the bottom line. So, obviously, Lantern is the big thing that everyone got to see finally in its cotillion, like, ugh. Anyways, I'm fine with it. Everything's fine.
Is everything awesome? You want me to play the Lego Movie song?
Maybe. All right. So the actual breakdown, how does the deck work? Why don't you sort of walk us through this, and then
how about you go through how the deck works, what you think about some of the cards, some of what's going on, and I'll talk about how we beat it.
Okay. So, like we touched on it being a prison deck, and what that means from a play perspective is you are attempting to keep your opponent from doing anything meaningful in the game. It's like one step below just flipping the table.
Yep.
Where your opponent literally can't do anything because there is no game. This is like one step below that. How does it work? It works by playing play sets of cards that are functionally like cards that are so powerful that they are restricted in Vintage, the most degenerate format in all of Magic. It plays Ancient Stirrings, which in this instance basically better ponder, restricted in Vintage. Mox Opal, it's a Mox, it's legendary, which is supposed to be its quote-unquote limiting factor with Metalcraft, but when your deck plays 8 zero-mana artifacts and 4 artifact lands, it's pretty easy to get Metalcraft turned on, and to make up for that, it just taps for any color. That's fine. And Tinker is probably a card that people are not as familiar with, but it is part of, it's an Urza Block card, and it's 2 and a blue, instant, second artifact, search your library for an artifact. Is it a sorcery?
Yeah, Tinker's a sorcery.
Oh, sorry.
So this card's better than Tinker.
it is qualitatively and quantitatively better than Tinker.
You don't even have to sack the artifact.
Correct. Like, so like Tinker, you sack the artifact, you search your library for another artifact and put it into play. So in Vintage, this is like Tinker for Blightseal Colossus.
Yeah, it's usually you're like tapping a Mox and sacrificing the Mox, and then like 2 lands to go put a 12 drop I win the game creature into play.
Yes. So, or like, I guess if you really want to go there, you can just be like Black Lotus, sack for 3 blue. Oh, no, you can't. You have to have 2. So you go, like, Black Lotus, Mox something, sack Lotus, cast Tinker, sack your Mox, go get a Blightsteel Colossus, go. And then if they don't have something that, if they can't drop at least a 2-2 on turn 1, they just lose.
For the record, Tinker has one other target in Vintage. There is a different card they get that's not Blightsteel.
What is it?
Memory Jar. The Storm Deck played is like a weird draw 7.
I don't feel good about that.
Beside the point. Not relevant to this at all.
Not relevant. So Wurr is just straight up better Tinker in the context of this deck, because Improvise is just is like a non-cost, and
it literally is just 3 mana tutor for any artifact in the deck and put it in play.
Right. At instant speed.
Yep.
And it is better than Tinker aside from its instant speed, which is ridiculous. In that, as you said, you don't have to sack the artifact. So your next Wurr always costs one less because you can just tap whatever the artifact is, because a lot of these artifacts don't care about being tapped or not. Like, there was a time when that made a difference, and it's a very strange callback, but like tapping your Ensnaring Bridge doesn't matter. Tapping your Witchbane Orb doesn't matter. So like, same thing with like Gear Per Aether Grid. Like, who cares, right? Play a bunch of stuff.
Interestingly, one of the artifacts that looks like it should tap, Welding Jar, is 0 mana and doesn't have a tap ability on it. So you can tap that and still use it, which is kind Welding of heinous Jar, in the deck.
Welding Jar is such a problematic card. Like, it really is. It's it's a ridiculous
card. I think it's fine, but It is particularly heinous in that you can tutor with it and use it to tap, and then its sacrifice ability doesn't also require a tap, which is not something they print anymore. Like, yeah. Now it's like anything like that always has tap and sac, and that one just does it for whatever reason.
Because we are 0% in the entire history of Magic, 25 years this year, where an artifact-centric block has failed to cause a gigantic problem with the game.
Well, the funny thing, is that, like, this block caused huge problems in Standard, right? For, like, a number of reasons. It's led to just numerous bannings left and right. But this isn't one of the cards, and yet it's, like, the most broken card in Modern now. Well, not the most, but, like, it's on the short list for, like, broken cards in Modern, right?
Yes. Yep. I mean, and yet, you know, every 5 years or so, man, we got to really, really, we're going to do it right this time. We're going to make an artifact set that's not going to break anything. And then just like apocalypse every single time. So,
yep.
I don't know, maybe just put it on the back burner for like 10 years this time.
Okay, let's make the next artifact block like shards where they were colored artifacts.
There you go.
Yep.
That's a thing. So generally you're going to lead off with like a partial hand dump into Thoughtseize or an Inquisition. And then get your Lantern online so you can see the top card of the library, get your Mill Rocks going. So Codex Shredder is like the best one. Because Codex Shredder has some very ridiculous additional text.
Well, it's the best one because it targets. It's the only one that targets.
Oh, that's true. So, Codex Shredder is 1 mana, and it's tap, target player puts top card of his or her library in his or her graveyard. It has 5 tap sack, return target card from your graveyard to your hand. Not artifact card, it's just any card. So, there is a speaking of slow kills, you can use Codex Shredder, Academy Ruins, Pyrite Spell Bomb. If you want to have the world's slowest Bomberman kill, you can do that too if it comes down to it. Like, if your opponent has, like, Emrakul, you can't win.
Yeah. Well, there was a feature... Well, you can, but there was a feature match where a guy was looping Collective Brutality to burn out an opponent. Just kept getting back Collective Brutality and Journeying for 2.
That was exceptional. I saw that. So that's the thing. So Codex Shredder is the one that you really want. In a pinch, Pixies of Pandemonium will do, and there are occasional times when it is preferable because it exiles. So that was one of the things that happened in the finals. Drop Pixies of Pandemonium. It's tap, each player exiles the top card of his or her library. It has some extra text, which never comes into play. Because that will literally never happen.
It's actively bad for the Lantern player to use the extra text.
It absolutely is. And then Ensnaring Bridge is creatures with power greater than the number of cards in your hand can't attack. I mean, this is a card that was printed in Stronghold originally, which was like functionally like the prehistoric times of card design.
It's passed for a good clean Magic card back then.
Yes. Yeah, this was totally fine. I don't even know that it really saw any play during its time in Standard. It's actually an interesting...
It was the sideboard tech to beat Lord of the Pit.
I guess.
Why you didn't just Swords to Plowshares it, nobody knows. But you could play this, and then Lord of the Pit had a very hard time attacking.
Yes, I guess it did. Oh, it was in Tezzerator and Extended.
Yeah, it's always been in Legacy decks.
Oh, man. What? This is basically, like, this is a deck that I would play so hard. Oh, my God. Bitter Blossom, Loam, Damnation, 4 Crime and Punishment. The card is legit. When we had, like, 3 Lantern players start coming to our store for their weeklies, so I just main decked, like, 3 Crime and Punishment and just blew them out every single time.
That's awesome.
It's like, oh, this X equals 1, destroy your entire board. Seems good. Get him. I did. So, during its time in Extended, Ensnaring Bridge was a piece of Tezzerator. It had a lot of the same kinds of things that we see today, except it also had, like, this was more of an old... Well, actually, even kind of like it's a chalice deck, basically. This is like what it boils down to. So, chalice, Chrome Mox, and it's Stifles. This is like a weird time. This is in 2009. There was a top 8 GP. Oh, Sam Black brought fairies to this and also top 8ed. But yeah, so Ensnaring Bridge has seen play before, and then it was an 8-rack piece for a long time, and then we kind of got away from it. It just didn't it wasn't as good as other things that were available. And then also, like, once Bantu's Last Reckoning got printed, there's just no reason to play it anymore.
Sure.
Because if they do if they do blow up the bridge, they can just like swing kill you. So Codex Shredder, Pyxis, there were older versions of this before Pyxis Pandemonium was printed. They played Ghoul Caller's Bell for a little while, which is another symmetrical, it's a symmetrical effect like Pyxis, but it just mills both players, doesn't exile. So less useful.
They also, Pyxis, I think, was printed while they were playing Ghoul Caller's Bell, but no one had realized Pyxis, like, was the card the deck wanted yet, I think.
Yeah, it was...
I think at this time they were main decking Surgical Extraction just to deal with Emrakul's.
Woof.
Yeah, like, I don't know. That was their plan.
That was a while ago. Yeah, because I played against this deck, like a proto version of this deck at, like, some nonsense side event at, like, PAX years and years and years ago. And it was running. It was still running Ghoul Caller's Bell, still running Surgical, all that kind of stuff. But now they have Silver Bullets that they can tutor for, as we said, instant speed, 7 discard spells.
I think, by the way, that graphic point, the Silver Bullets they can tutor for is what makes Whirr so broken in the deck. It's like,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's like, yeah, obviously it's really good. Like, if your lock is, like, a combination of 4 pieces or whatever, like, it's really good at finding the piece you didn't draw, right? And just, like, finishing assembling the lock, but, like, sometimes you play against Dredge and you just have five Grafdigger's Cages in your main deck for whatever reason now, you know?
Yeah. Well, and even more than that with Ancient Stirrings.
Sure. I mean, Ancient Stirrings hitting a one-of is less likely, but, like, the fact that you can tutor for your one-of is just outrageous, right? Like, mm-hmm. And you have Mox Opal to do it, so, like, if you're playing as Dredge and you're on the play, like, you can legitimately just tutor for Grafdigger's Cage on turn two sometimes. Like, that just happens.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, Inventor's Fair also has... You can pay four, sack it, search your library for an artifact, reveal it, put it in your hand... and it basically has Metalcraft to activate this ability only if you control three or more artifacts. But that's a thing.
Yeah.
Like, this is a ridiculous card.
Well, and that's like, part of what put Lantern completely over the edge, too, is, like, before, its worst matchup by miles was Burn. This deck, like, could never beat Burn. It had such an atrociously bad Burn matchup. And now you can just tutor for a Leyline of Sanctity at instant speed on turn three, like, a lot of times. Which is good enough.
Yep. Yeah, so having Witchbane Orb in the main, Grafdigger's Cage, three bridges. They have main deck one Abrupt Decay. Just seems fine. Like, it's good miscellaneous permanent removal.
Well, the other thing, too, about, like, just having one is that, like you said, they have Codex Shredder. So, like, if they need to Abrupt Decay two things, they just put you in a lock and then Abrupt Decay two things.
Right. And the sideboard is a lot of kind of similar stuff. Another Pithing Needle, because they run two in the main, which is usually enough to cover, like, most people's win cons. Or even, like, if you get it early enough, and if you're in your opening hand of, like, game two, you can just, like, Pithing Needle there, fetch land, and sometimes that is good enough. Like, I've played... multiple games, not many games, where I'm just like, oh, okay, sure, Pithing Needle, Verdant Catacombs, and they're just like, okay, guess I won't do anything for five turns.
Yep.
This is also the number of Pithing Needles that are going to be registered in the world is probably another reason to diversify your fetch lands. Like, it seems corner case, and it is, but it's also not nothing, and it doesn't, other than, I guess, costing you money, there's no disadvantage to running, like, a variety of fetch lands, so you're not just on, like, a potential lockout from a Pithing Needle.
Yeah, like, for instance, if you were in a two-color deck, like, let's say you're playing, like, a red-white deck, right? Like, I think, for sure, if you're playing both Mountain and Plains, you still want four Arid Mesa before anything else.
Absolutely.
But then after that, I'd play, like, one Bloodstained Mire, one Scalding Tarn, you know? Like, I would diversify after the ones that get basics.
Sure. And then, yeah, I mean, they play, like, good green, black, and blue cards. Like, Search for Azkanta, Tezzeret Agent of Bolas is, like, a very strong win con for them. Because it just... The minus four, like, you play it, plus one, look at the top five, like, another five deep dig. You know, put an artifact in your hand, of which there are, by the way, 26. So that's a strong possibility of a hit. And... then, like, you ultimate him next turn, minus four. Target player loses X life. You gain X life, where X is twice the number of artifacts you control. So, just, let's say, on average, you're just going to be a 10 somebody. Like, drain you for 10. Seems good.
Yeah, I mean, and it's then a great way jar. To win through Bridge, right?
Yes. And Welding Jar is a ridiculous magic card. It costs zero. And it regenerates an artifact, so even your main thing where you're like, oh, I will just Ancient Grudge their whatever, Ancient Grudge their Codex Shredder, you have to also Ancient Grudge their Welding Jar. And you can't even really do that, because if you Ancient Grudge their Welding Jar... they can sack their welding jar to give their Codex Shredder a regeneration shield, and then you can't even flash it back to blow up that particular Codex Shredder.
Yep.
Welding jar. So that's basically that. So if you're on the other side of the table and you know that you have a creature-based win condition and you see a bridge, you see two Codex Shredders and a Lantern of Insight, just scoop.
Yep.
Like, and if you're playing Burn and you don't have a way to exile a Witchbane Orb, just scoop.
Sure.
And there are plenty of ways to do it. Like, it's not that these cards don't exist. It's just, as of right now, they're not commonly played. And so, like, we'll go into a couple of them. So, yeah, I mean, it has, like, gacha deck elements to it, and a lot of gacha decks rely on winning game one, and it is a very good game one deck. And game two, it gets a lot harder, but if you waste all your time in game one, you're not going to have enough time to play game two and three where you're at least even or favored. So get to the good stuff, control your salt. And this is also like, this is advice from me to me that I am not always great at taking, just because I have so much disdain for prison decks as a whole. But it's right. It's reality on reality's terms. People are going to be playing it. I need to be prepared to play against it, and play optimally against it. So why don't you teach me how to play optimally against it?
Sure. Yeah. So just to touch on something you mentioned there too, is like, it really has a good game one win percentage. And that's partly, again, because of Whirr. Like, they're pre-sideboarded against a lot of decks where they have the five Grafdigger's Cages. So, like, if you're playing against Lantern and you know you can't win, like, it might be right to just scoop 2 minutes in a game one. Like, honestly, like, the deck plays a lot of discard spells, so, like, if you know that, like, your deck is just cold to Lantern game one and you think they have, like, a semi-functional draw, like, they started out with, like, a bunch of stuff and a Mox Opal or whatever, like, it might be worth just conceding the game and concealing information at that point, just because, you know, it matters, because they're a deck that relies on information so much. So that is a relevant plan, but more importantly, what you're interested in is beating this deck. And what we want to give you, the listener, right now is some advice to beat it and a mindset of how we beat this deck, right? So at first, like, the first couple times you play against the deck, it is confusing. It locks you out a lot quicker than you would expect, and the lock is a lot harder than it seems like at any given time, right? So that's why we're saying, like, the basic rule is two millstones, a bridge, and a lantern, and they have no cards in hand. They have you locked out, and that's generally going to be true. There are ways that you could get out of that specific lock, but they're generally less likely than them finding a way to deal with the way that would get out of that lock, right? So her basic rule, once they have two millstones, be it Pyxis or Codex Shredder, whatever, and a lantern and a bridge, you probably have lost at this point. So we can concede there. But if we're interested in beating it, we have to kind of understand what their game plan is. And obviously, in Modern in general, it's a format kind of defined by Affinity, kind of from the beginning of the format. Affinity's been a, you know, very defining deck. And so when you look at decks now, like the way decks are constructed, almost every single deck has some sort of artifact hate card in it. It's very rare to see really any deck that doesn't have some way to deal with an artifact in its sideboard. And you would think that is really bad news for this deck, right? That, like, you know, every deck already had Stony Silence, this deck gets destroyed by it. But when you actually play against the deck, it's kind of attacking you on two fronts. So it's not really that simple. You can't just board in Stony Silence and think you have it beat. So I guess to give you a better idea of how we're going to attack beating the deck, I'm going to give you kind of what you need to beat, because I think that's the part people miss when they go about building their sideboard for this deck. And what it's doing, right, is it's casting a bunch of discard spells to first strip your hand of answers so that you don't have anything in hand that is going to beat them. And then it establishes a lock where it controls what you draw. So first it says you don't have relevant cards, then it says you can't draw relevant cards, and then it says you don't have an attack phase, the game is over. Well, to beat this, you need to draw relevant cards, or have enough relevant cards in your hand that they can't strip you of all of them. And what that means is, having two Stony Silence in your deck isn't going to beat this deck. Like, yes, if you resolve a Stony Silence, you're in a great spot. You probably have a very good chance to win, but the problem is that they can discard it, they can abrupt decay your Stony Silence, and they can stop you from drawing it if it's not in your opening hand. So it puts you in spots where you need to mulligan to answers, but that's also bad because they're a discard deck, right? So they're attacking you on a lot of fronts. Well, how do we beat this? One, the simplest card is Leyline of Sanctity. If you have a Leyline of Sanctity in your opening hand, they can't make you discard your answers. In fact, they can't interact with your hand at all. And they have a very hard time controlling your draw step. And on top of this, they don't really have cards in their main deck that destroy it. Like, a lot of them will play, like, one Seal of Primordium and, like, one Maelstrom Pulse. Like, that's it. That's all they'll have to destroy this. So they can't tutor for those. A Leyline of Sanctity will almost cold lock them out of the game a lot of times. And that lets you draw your Ancient Grudges that destroy their bridge. It lets you draw the Stony Silence that turns everything else off. Leyline of Sanctity, I think, is the single best. If you only could devote a couple sideboard cards, it's like the single best one to beat this deck. But outside of that, the next best way to beat discard is to just have a mass of answers so they can't effectively make you discard all of them. So it's like, if you just had, you know, four Nature's Claim, four Stony Silence, four Ancient Grudge, three Abrupt Decay in your sideboard, it's probably unlikely, but if that is what your sideboard was and you could cast all those cards, this deck would have a really hard time beating it because you have so many draw steps that are relevant, they have a hard time controlling it. You have so many cards that you can draw that your opening hand is probably going to be chock full of things that shut them down. And it is very good at, they can take one piece away from you, but they are not going to be able to take two or whatever, maybe three. So, like, if you have a bunch of them in your hand, you're probably going to win. It probably just, it overwhelms what their deck is doing. Now, what that means is that, no, you cannot just say, I'm going to put 15 Artifact Hate cards in my sideboard. That's not realistic. This is a modern format where your sideboard space is already stretched. You need to diversify your answers. But what that does mean is, maybe you're deciding between two cards that are close in another matchup. Well, you know, now with how good Lantern is doing, maybe you pick the one that's also good in the Lantern matchup, where it's like, maybe I wanted to play Anger of the Gods or Engineered Explosives in my Jeskai deck as a sweeper. Well, right now I'm going to hedge towards Engineered Explosives because it's good against Lantern. Or, you know, other similar things. Maybe it's like, you know, maybe I played whatever against Burn. Well, maybe now my sideboard hate against Burn is going to be Leyline of Sanctity because it's so good against Lantern. And yes, these might cost you small percentage points in other matchups, but because this deck is so good and it's going to be more prevalent going forward, it's probably right to make these switches now. And lastly, the thing I wanted to talk about as just another good plan for beating the deck is instant speed card draw. What this means is that it's kind of like a way, like, obviously people think instant speed card draw is good, but it is kind of a way to circumvent their mill rocks, right? It gives you more control over what you're drawing, and what that means, you know, kind of format contextually, is that maybe, you know, I think Serum Visions is a much better card than Opt, but maybe playing four Opt in your main deck over four Serum Visions gives you a better Lantern matchup. I think that's something you have to consider now when you're choosing your blue cantrips.
It's yes, yes, asterisk. That is only the case with if they have a single Milrock. If they have two, card draw doesn't work anymore.
Well, it still does in the sense that they are going to be draw steps that they can't control, right? So, like, with Opt, you get to scry one and then draw a card. They can never... They can control the card that you would get to see on the scry, but they can never stop you from drawing the card that is underneath the scry. Which is also blind to you, but at the same time, they can't stop you from drawing that card. So if there is a good card underneath, well, Opt is going to be better against this Milrock plan. And it has the bonus of, like, say they tap, like, there's, like, a Kolaghan screen on top of your library, right? They don't want you to draw that. So they say, mill that. You cast Opt, right? Now, you might scry that one to the bottom so that the card they're going to mill is... Or, well, so what they're going to do is they're going to respond with their second one and try to mill the Kolaghan's command. Well, now that might get milled, but then you get two draw steps that they're not controlling, right? Where it's like, you kind of just have to hope that whatever is underneath it works for you.
Yeah, but, it feels like such a bad plan.
Well, huh?
I mean, it's better than nothing.
I agree with you. Yes, it's not perfect. This is not like the... end all be all to beating this deck, but it is a good way to kind of, I don't know, to kind of beat them, right?
The weird sly way to like draw against them is Chromatic Sphere, because the draw card is part of the mana ability, so they can't respond to it. I don't know that people need to start playing Chromatic Spheres in their main deck, but I'm sure if you looked hard enough, you could find other things that have similarly written clauses where the draw effect is part of the mana ability, which sort of protects it from that mill interaction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go that deep that I would suggest playing these cards in other decks, but I think you're onto something here, is that there are decks that are playing effects that are already good against them. And when I'm talking instant speed card draw, another like very common thing in the format now... from the Shadows of Innistrad block, by the way, is the Clue token. That is a very common form of instant speed card draw we're starting to see more of in Modern, whether it be mm-hmm. Thraven Inspector, Tireless Tracker, and it's very likely in these Lantern decks that you're going to flood out. They kind of make it so that once you're locked out, you just kind of draw a bunch of lands. Well, the card Tireless Tracker is specifically very, very good against Lantern, because every land you draw gives you an instant speed card draw, so it kind of like lets you overwhelm their Codex Shredder pieces.
Yep.
So that's a great card against them. Thraven Inspector gives you an instant speed card draw. The card Horizon Canopy, very good, gives you some instant speed card draw. There are little ways that you can change decks that don't cost you very much that just make you better against this deck. And that is more of what I'm suggesting here, is that, we're not talking sweeping changes to the format. We're talking about the little changes you can make that give you percentage points in this matchup. And I think that's something people haven't done enough of, but need to do more of. And that's why I love, like, your suggestion of Chromatic Sphere is, like, yeah, that's in Tron, but, like, knowing that interaction gives you a huge edge is, like, maybe you were going to crack your Chromatic Sphere to... Ancient Stirrings or Sylvan Scrying on turn two or whatever, but maybe it's better to save it if you're playing against Lantern so that you can draw that O-Stone you need to draw or whatever.
Yep.
And then one other point I would like to mention about the deck is that it actually can be locked out. I've had success with the cards. Chalice of the Void is very good against their deck because it really shuts them off getting Milrocks into play. And also can stop their like zero mana baubles and whatnot. And then Thalia Guardian of Thraven can really prevent them from emptying their hand and lets you like with the humans deck specifically, just kind of get under their empty their hand, get a bridge and play draws and just kill them before they can do that. So that card's very good against them. And then the Eldrazi Tron deck is also surprisingly good against Lantern just because it has so many cards with activated abilities. So activated abilities on creatures is another good thing to have in the matchup. Also, like, the core decks have Duskwatch Recruiter. Duskwatch Recruiter being able to look for creatures is very relevant. So, yeah, like, Walking Ballista is quite good against them. All these things that are, like, on-table interaction, like, they have Pithing Needles, but they only have so many Pithing Needles, and Eldrazi Tron specifically has, like, Karn and Walking Ballista and Endbringer and, you know, Ulamog to some extent. So there's, like, a lot of things that the deck can cast that, you know, just kind of work in play that beat the Lantern deck, I guess. So, you know, going forward, just kind of look for these little interactions. See if you can add it to your deck. Maybe if you're playing... Maybe you're going to play, like, a black-green rock deck. Well, maybe you should include, like, one Horizon Canopy. Or maybe it's an Abzan deck. Maybe it's, you know, Reduke's Abzan deck. Maybe you consider playing one Horizon Canopy in it. Who knows? But, yeah, so that's the plan going forward. Let's make some little changes and then kind of slant our sideboard cards to beat the deck.
Agree. One of the things that I wanted to just sort of pick up on is... When you are picking your artifact removal, I would favor, if possible, things that exile, things that tuck, things that have split second, or things that have that say can't be regenerated. There
also
are
bounce.
Number
the record bounce is very good.
Oh, bounce. Yep. Yeah, bounce is fine. So there's a bunch of exile effects. I mean, as simple as it was a Boros card from Return to Ravnica, Shattering Blow. I mean, it's like one hybrid red white exile target artifact. I'm sure there's a better one. Oxidize is great. It's single green, destroy target artifact, can't be regenerated. Crimson Grip, also great. Split second, so it can't be responded to. Unravel the Aether is one that I really like, that I play in the sideboard of black green. It's shuffle target artifact.
It's literally just naturalized, but it shuffles into the library.
Yes. Which is relevant because, man, Academy Ruins is obnoxious in this deck.
Oh yeah.
And the fact that you can use Codex Shredder to loop your Academy Ruins in case it gets destroyed. As few people are running exile artifact effects, there are even fewer people that are running exile land effects.
Yeah.
So it's unlikely, extremely unlikely, that you're going to be able to, you know, just straight exile somebody's land.
On that note, I wanted to make a point, too, just about a sideboard card choice. If you're trying to decide between... like Leyline of the Void / Rest in Peace right now, I would suggest Relic of Regenitus, because I think Relic of Regenitus is very, very good against the Lantern deck. It stops all their graveyard shenanigans with, you know, milling and whatnot, but it's also instant speed card draw when you need to just try and fight a war over your draw step, if you will.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, look out for Welding Jar.
Welding Jar will get you. Another point on playing stuff that, like, bounce. Hurgle's Recall is very good against them. It puts a bunch of stuff back in their hand. A common line I have used in the past to beat Lantern with, like, say, a Jeskai deck, is sometimes they will have, like, multiple bridges in play, and you know that you can't... Like, all you have is a bounce, like a Cryptic Command, for instance. Like, you know you can't get both bridges back in their hand in a meaningful way, so you'll be able to attack. What you can do is bounce a land, so you can attack with 1/1s.
Sure.
Because the bridge, they actually have to have 0 cards in hand, so bouncing a land is a common play pattern. And then one other card that is particularly amazing against this deck is Shattering Spree, very common in Storm decks. Regenerate only stops the first time it would be destroyed in a turn, so if they regenerate their bridge and you just target it twice with, you know, a Shattering Spree and the replicated Shattering Spree, the bridge is going to die.
Okay.
So that is a very good card against the deck. It's part of the reason why Storm's matchup against Lantern is amazing.
Good to know. So we can touch on unbans. I mean, pretty quickly. There's just many, 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 many people, myself included, you know, have been speculating.
Well, hey, before you get into unbanned, do you want to hit on bans real quick? Do you think this Pro Tour warranted anything being banned?
I think this Pro Tour is a convenient time to ban Ancient Stirrings without rustling any jimmies.
I could see that. Because,
like, it's a card that needs to be taken care of. It does not kill any deck. It turns down the volume on like two decks that need to have the volume turned down on them, which is Lantern and Tron. Like, neither of those decks is going to be like, oh my god, Ancient Stirrings, I'm just going to set these cards on fire. But it will make them enough, it will remove enough of the consistency that they currently enjoy to give the rest of the field like a little bit of breathing room.
Yeah, and honestly, like, I don't even know how much taking Ancient Stirrings out of Lantern would do to the deck. Like, if you banned Ancient Stirrings and the deck just had to play Serum Visions in its place, like, I think it's worse, but I don't think it's that much worse. I think it's a very minor change for the deck, honestly.
Yeah, somebody asked me about it. A listener asked me about it, and I said, honestly, I would start practicing, like, try to run some games with Glintness Crane.
Sure.
In the Ancient Stirring slot, because I think that's the most sort of comparable replacement, and it also, like, has advantages in the sense that, like, it gives you a blocker while you're getting your bridge set up. I think it's at least worth considering, because that's a non-zero thing.
No, it's also very interesting that it's a flying attacker that you can attack with an Ensnaring Bridge in play, because you can, like, draw your card for turn, attack for one in the air, play your card, go. Yeah. But I think I would start with Serum Visions if that card got banned. Again, I don't really think they're going to ban anything. I don't think this Pro Tour warranted a banning of any sort, but I think you made a good point that if they wanted to take care of Ancient Stirrings, this would be a good time to do it. And I think the card warrants being taken care of, so I could see that one. I don't really think there's going to be any other bans. I don't really think the format's really calling for it right now. I just think that...
I think that the artifact-based decks, this one in particular, needs to either have better Ponder, Tinker, or Mox something. Like, pick two, and I feel like that's better.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little too consistent right now playing against the deck.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, I don't think there's going to be any bannings, but those cards have been on the watch list anyway, so I think if those cards, like Ancient Stirrings and or Mox Opal, any of those got banned, I don't think anybody would be totally stunned.
Yeah. So unbans, I only have one unban, like, in my head, which is Bloodbraid Elf. I am not completely convinced that it would not cause problems. But, you know, because back in the day it was like ramp into Bloodbraid Elf, cascade into Blightning, like OP. But now it's like turn two. Yeah, you can get four mana on turn two. So, like, turn two Bloodbraid Elf, cascade into Colgan's Command, like, shock you, discard, hit you for three. Like, or, like, get back my something else. I just... There's four-color nonsense decks that are already in existence, and Bloodbraid Elf has been part of four-color nonsense decks in the past. So, granted, alongside Deathrite Shaman, which is the prime offender, but, you know, a Jundi was a real deck, you know?
Yeah, I mean...
Jund with Lingering Souls and Planeswalkers was big game, and...
Look, Aaron, I agree with you that these were real things, but they just aren't anymore. I mean, look, let's be honest.
But they could be.
They could be, but, like, let's be honest right now. Is Bloodbraid Elf even better than Collected Company? Like, I don't think that's clear. I think Collected Company being an instant and getting, you know, six mana worth of cards is generally better than anything Bloodbraid is doing. I think Bloodbraid is better than Siege Rhino, but, again, Abzan top-8ed the Pro Tour, and there were zero copies of Siege Rhino on the list. And I don't think Bloodbraid is that much better than Siege Rhino. I think it's a comparable card. In fact, I don't even think there's a single Siege Rhino registered at the Pro Tour. Like, not even one copy in any deck anywhere. And I think they're
unlikely.
I think they are comparable cards. And when Tron is casting Karn on turn 3, you getting a 3-2 haste on turn 4 is not even that impressive. And when Lantern says you don't get to attack on turn 3, what does this 3-2 haste even do for you? It's literally like 4 mana, maybe flip into a 3 drop. And then the fact that the card just has a fail rate, like sometimes you cascade into, Inquisition of Kozilek, and they just don't have any 3 or less cards in their hand because they're empty-handed, or they just have like a 4 drop in hand or whatever. Or sometimes you hit, Fatal Push, and they don't have a creature in play. You're playing against Ad Nauseam. Like, I just don't buy it that this card is too strong for Modern anymore. And in fact, I'm not even convinced the card's playable. I could see
the thing. Okay, so here's what I think you are missing, and that card is Grimflayer.
Sure, I could see it being good with Grimflayer.
Like, between, like, Grimflayer to set up not only your Dark Confidant draws, but also your Bloodbraid Elf Cascades, has insane potential.
See, but, like that's, like, a win more thing anyway, though, is, like, you're already hitting them with your Grimflayer, like, how much more do you need to win, right? Like, it's already scrying you to what you're, like, the good draws anyway. Like, yes, I think that's a powerful interaction, but, like, that's what your deck looks like when it's doing its thing. Like, I don't know. I think that's just fine in Modern. I think that's something that you can just accept as, yeah, this is this deck's, like, nut draw. This is cool. Let them do their thing, you know?
Sure. So, you had some pie in the sky that you wanted to talk about.
Well, so, I am of the opinion that Stoneforge could be unbanned. I think this one's more controversial than Bloodbraid, for sure. I think it's very... The resistance to Bloodbraid has grown very small at this point. I can see there being, resistance to Bloodbraid, but I think the majority of Modern players think Bloodbraid's safe. Stoneforge is a bit more contentious. I know people that think Stoneforge is a completely safe unban and it's just at the correct power level of a 2-drop in the format. I know people that think the card's way too broken. I think that from a baseline perspective of I tested a blue-white deck against a Jund deck, Stoneforge felt good but not broken. It felt like a powerful card, but one that was the correct power level of the format. But that was a baseline very shallow dig into the card in the format itself, and I could see it being dangerous. I think there are equipment in this format that are scary, specifically Cranial Plating and Sword of the Meek. And for that reason, I'm not sure that now's the right time, especially with how healthy the format was. So while I personally think that this one could be unbanned, I am totally okay with them just not doing anything with it and letting it sit.
Okay. How often do you want to get blown out by Argentum Armor on turn 3?
I don't even know what Argentum Armor does. What does it do?
It's a 6-mana equipment from Scars.
Okay.
Equipped creature gets +6/+6.
Okay.
And whenever equipped creature attacks, destroy target permanent.
How much does it cost to equip?
6. Or 0.
What do you mean 0?
There's tons of stuff that lets you equip for 0.
Oh, sure, like the Pure Steel Paladin or whatever?
Yeah, it's a bunch of stuff.
I don't know. That to me just seems like one of those things where it's like, that's Modern power level. Like, if this deck successfully put this together and is doing its thing, like, cool, man, you did your thing. You you got it. It's like, this doesn't seem more powerful than, like, what Kark Clan Ironworks is doing, or Storm with Baral, or all of that stuff. Like,
oh, God, my dream is for them to ban Kark Clan Ironworks. Just, like, housekeeping. Sure. Like, hey, we should have banned this card a long time ago, because it just keeps getting dumber.
I mean, that's fair.
And, like, we keep printing cards. Like, scrap trawler that just like randomly make this viable again, and then like somebody will bring it to a pro tour and people will have to watch it.
Yep.
And it's awful.
Yep.
So that's my dream is ban Kirkland Ironworks and Ancient Stirrings, unban Bloodbraid Elf.
Okay. I mean, I think the Kirkland Ironworks is a bit of a shot in the dark, but it could happen. I don't think that card is particularly healthy for the format, so.
I mean, like I said, it's on my wish list. Like, somebody at Wizards would get a fruit basket for me if they banned Kirkland Ironworks.
That's fair. You know what, Aaron? So, you know what I need to do right now?
Go buy a fruit basket?
I might. I might need to buy a fruit basket just for you, because I need to say that I was wrong. You were right. I'm sorry. You knew it the whole time. Jace the Mind Sculptor should be sitting on the bench still and...
literally forever.
I don't know about forever. I'm not willing to go that far yet. But I will concede that he should not be unbanned right now, and that you were right for the last X period of time in which we've been debating this.
Yes.
Because... forever. No, not forever.
Since the day we met,
this probably. Is fair, yes, for that long. But I thought... okay, so Jace, while being maybe at an egregious power level, I don't think you can deny that if blue was very bad, Jace would have helped blue, right? Like, that would have been totally true because of how powerful Jace is, right? But I think Search for Azcanta did enough to put blue to a healthy spot in the format that blue doesn't need Jace right now. And in fact, I'm becoming more and more scared of Jace index like Lantern, where you get to start fate sealing your opponent. Or, you know, in like Through the Breach decks, Jace in Storm kind of terrifies me, where you just cast a turn 2 Jace the Mind Sculptor. These are not things I want to see. And I am pretty happy if Jace doesn't get unbanned. And this is coming from somebody who really, really wanted Jace unbanned, like, as recent as a month ago. So, yeah, you were right, man. I gotta give it to you on that one.
Yep. Rip Jace forever. For the foreseeable future. There we go.
I will give foreseeable future.
There. So.
I'm not conceding forever. There's a chance.
Sure, there's always a chance. Hey, look, maybe they'll just unban all the artifact lands and we can go back to Atog Fling just like Richard Garfield intended.
Let's please not do that either. That doesn't sound that fun to me. I've played Pauper.
It's not.
I've played Pauper.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's so funny. But before we get to the spice rack, you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/turn1thoughtseize, all spelled out. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at @T1Thoughtseize. Zach is at @A22EN. You can watch the stream at twitch.tv/T1Thoughtseize, brought to you by our friends at Card Hoarder. You can see our YouTube videos, youtube.com/turn1thoughtseize, all spelled out. You can see all of our content on turn1thoughtseize.com. And lastly, if you are listening to us on iTunes, please remember to rate and review us. You picked the Spice Rack card. It is a redo classic, which you have determined to be criminally underplayed. So I will let you take that one away.
Yeah. Also, Josh Utter Layton has a little bit of claim to this one. It was in his Pro Tour second place Countercat deck from Pro Tour Philadelphia in, I believe, 2011.
Yes. Oh yeah. Yep.
The card is Bant Charm. It is a green, a white, and a blue. 3 mana, for an instant from, I believe, Shards of Alara? I think it's Shards. So yeah, one of the Alara, it was the Alara block. And it says, choose one, destroy target artifact, or put target creature on the bottom of its owner's library, or counter target instant spell. And why I'm suggesting this right now is that, much like Kolaghan's Command, it is very powerful to have a multi-optional card that also just destroys an artifact in your main deck. It kind of buys back some of that game one percentage that decks like Affinity and Lantern and Tron and decks of the sort steal from you by playing cards you can't interact with in their main deck, right? Sure. So, like, having, you know, destroy target artifact on this removal spell that you were going to play anyway is, you know, very strong. And, in fact, all of its modes are very, very good. In fact, I defy you to find a matchup where one of its modes isn't relevant. I don't think you can in the format. You know, destroy target artifact is very relevant in the, it's very, very good in the matchups it's good in, and in other matchups it doesn't have text, but that's okay. You're mostly playing it for the second mode, which is put target creature on the bottom of its owner's library, and that's good, right? That's just like a better path to exile type effect. It's like an exile effect on an instant speed removal spell that's unconditional. Just any creature, bottom of their library, there you go. The only thing it's not going to hit is a hexproof creature, but, you know, what are you going to do? There are definitely decks that want to play Path to Exile on their sideboard, and I could see decks even like Bant Collected Company that, you know, play Path to Exiles that, Path to Exile is definitely better than this card if you're just looking for creature removal, but maybe, you know, you're trying to get those 17th and 18th cards in your sideboard. Maybe this is an awesome sideboard in Bant Coco decks right now. I don't know. But then in decks where destroy target artifact and the creature mode aren't relevant, those decks play instants. I guarantee you they do. And there it has counter target instant spell. So, you know, you're playing against your no creatures cryptic command deck. Boom, I'm going to counter your cryptic, which they definitely don't see coming out of your Bant creature deck. Or, you know, even against Lantern, maybe you don't want to destroy the artifact. Maybe they already have the Welding Jar in play, and you're just going to cast your Whirr, or they're casting their Whirr. Well, you can counter the Whirr. Or, you know, you're playing against Ad Nauseam, no creatures, you can counter Ad Nauseam. So, it's a very underplayed card. It has a lot of relevant modes, so you're very likely right now, if you're playing it, to catch people off guard and get them. And I like that. So I think, The awkward part for this card right now is finding a home, but I think you could find a home. I think maybe you could do like a blue-white control deck that has like Tarmogoyf in it, or, you know, any Noble Hierarch deck could consider this, and Noble Hierarch's a very played card. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's I think the card's powerful enough that it's worth looking. So,
right.
Yeah,
I will agree. Even I would go so far as too strong agree. And it was from Shards, by the way. I looked it up.
Cool.
Yeah, I missed the Alara block, so I was like, but I don't know what these symbols are. That is that. We'll put a bow on it, and we will catch up with you next time.
Awesome, man. Good talking to you.